Welcome to another episode of Inside UMiami Medicine podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Henry Forward, the Dean and Chief Academic Officer, the University of Miami Leonard M. Miller School of Medicine. This morning, we welcome to the studio Dr. Elizabeth Gregg. Dr. Gregg is the co-director of our Global Institute, a team that advances critical response missions across the globe. Along with her team, Dr. Gregg has been on the front lines of some of the most devastating environmental crises in recent years, and she's been involved in this important work since she was a first-year medical student at the University of Miami Middle School of Medicine. Additionally, she is now an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine. She's the medical director of one of our UHealth primary care practices and a proud alumna of the Miller School. Dr. Gregg, it is such a pleasure to welcome you to the studio.
So flattered to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, today we're really going to talk about a topic that I know is near and dear to your heart and certainly to mine,
yes,
which is disaster medicine. But before we get into the substance of this podcast, tell us a little bit about your background, your journey to becoming the co-director of the Global Health Institute here. And so we can get to know you.
You know, it's funny looking back on it. It seems so haphazard, although I guess there's some rhyme and rhythm to it. You know, I turned down a career in comedy, actually, right out of college.
And no.
Took the next natural step. I know. And now I'm the biggest downer at this hospital system because all I talk about is disaster. So, but that's true. I actually went into management consulting right after that.
But before we get there, yeah. So what did you grow up and tell us about that?
All right. All the way back. All the way back. I'm from Philadelphia. And then we bounced around a little bit as kids, grew up in England. We're back and forth from the U.S. I ended up moving back to Philadelphia for college, went to Penn, wasn't pre-med, and had sort of very limited direction, hence the near-death experience with a comedy career. And then ended up, you know, out of college, wandering around and going into management consulting. And then through, like, these wacky circumstances, you know, ended up on a healthcare desk, was doing consulting to academic medical centers, which, like, I don't know why that would inspire anyone to go into academic medicine, but I decided I wanted to be part of the problem as opposed to part of the solution, and decided to come back to go to medical school. Had to do a post-bac and ended up doing that at University of Miami for no apparent reason, but fell in love with Miami. And then ultimately, when trying to figure out where to go to medical school, had a very, like, chance encounter with Paul Farmer. And I was at the time, very interested in global health. And Paul Farmer just took me aside and said, you know, in a chance meeting at a bar, said, you know, if you really want to do this seriously and you want an institution that's going to turn you into a global health practitioner for real, for life, go to the University of Miami. So you can't get better career advice than that, especially in a bar. So I did it. I did as I was told, and he was 100% right, as he often was, and here I am. So
remarkable. So
before I even started the whole thing. So yeah.
Before you're in studying med school.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about what happened. So you get here, you're in medical school,
right?
And you get involved very quickly,
right,
with Dr. Garth Green.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, talk about mentorship. You know, jackpot there. I was so impressed, I think, by Miami, the city, as being just this big melting pot of need, essentially, and a very interesting place that was not at all like, you know, the Northeastern institutions that I was kind of used to. That when the opportunity came up to work in Haiti with Dr. Green, you know, I took it. It was Christmas of my first year, and I was down in Haiti with Lynn for the first time. You know, they through Project MediShare, we were kind of looking at their primary care system. Project MediShare is you know, at the time was a primary care delivery system, a nonprofit organization that was working.
NGO.
Yeah, that was working out in a rural area of Haiti, essentially doing community health, you know, primary care delivery.
So what's the first year medical student doing out there?
Yeah, good question. I mean, the essentially augmenting their services, right? At the time, you know, they were a standalone organization delivering community health. And we were there to learn from them. And on those trips, go down and sort of augment the services, do extra health fairs, get more people into their community health practice. And that was my first foray of working in Haiti. After those initial trips working in primary care, I had a brief moment where I thought I was going to be a trauma surgeon. And so I was doing, yeah, I know, exactly. More insanity, but I started looking at kind of more the emergency services and surgical capacity and what was available in Haiti at the time. And that turned into my sort of research focus and what we were looking at in terms of developing, in terms of service delivery through MediShare and through UM, developing surgical capability and assessing what would happen if there were a big emergency, particularly in Port-au-Prince, what those services looked like.
Well, great. So, I mean, and let me go back to this flirting with becoming a trauma surgeon. Even Paul Farmer used to say that if he had to do it all over, he would have been a trauma surgeon. And probably, although infectious disease is very important, which is what he did, especially in the global South. But the being a surgeon, especially as we now start talking about disaster, it gives you more capabilities to intervene right in the heart of a disaster. So tell us a little bit about that evolution.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think, you know, when medical students come to me and say, what's the most practical thing for me to go into if I'm looking at a career in global health? I really do encourage people to really strongly think about surgery. I mean, you can make a tremendous intervention. It's a neglected area in terms of global health service delivery. It's more, you know, cost effective than people imagine it to be. And there should be more surgeons working in global health. You know, I have one thing I love about being on the faculty at Miami now is that those people that influenced me as a medical student, they're all still here, right? So, and that's a testament to this place. But I remember, you know, getting way down this pathway and saying to Larry Sands at one point, you know, do you think it's problematic at this point that while I'm mesmerized by being in the OR, I actually don't really like learning how to do the stuff, right? Throwing in the stitches and doing all the anatomy. And Larry was like, yeah, that's a problem.
Right.
I got some very solid career advice right then and there. And I think I am kind of a classic general internist kind of person. So I think, you know, my advice to medical students is if you want to go into global health and you want to do, you know, whatever you want to do, you know, pick whatever you who your people are in medicine, and you can make that happen in a career in global health.
So disaster response has been a primary focus of the Global Institute.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us, why is it important for an academic institution such as ours, you know, that sits at the gateway to Latin America and the Caribbean, to be engaged in disaster response? Why is that something we should take seriously?
Yeah. I mean, disaster response, I think, is a field that's becoming increasingly professionalized. And we saw that after Haiti 2010, that the players on the field have been really consolidated into more professional organization, that having a very thoughtful, calculated disaster response, that is so important for the decades of fallout from a disaster that you see after that. People need to study that and need to make this a field that where you really understand the long-term implications of what you do on day one of a disaster. And an academic institution is perfect for that. And I think, you know, the one thing about, you know, UM and Haiti 2010 is that UM had a very personal connection to that disaster, right? And so we were a natural place to have to field a response. That response was enormous, what came out of UM. I mean, in
retrospect. You're talking about the Haiti earthquake.
Yeah, in 2010. Yeah.
So tell us about that, because here you were, a fourth year medical student.
I know.
And ended up playing a pivotal role in that process.
I know. Guess
all of that primary care preparation and.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Get you ready for such a time as this.
I mean, you're in a little bit of a suspended animation as a medical student. You sort of think like I am outside of the process. But I had spent 3 years researching, you know, who was on the field in Port-au-Prince, where all the hospitals were. I knew everybody. I knew where they were. I could drive to them. You know, I could get, you know, I knew what was available. And so when UM launched a response, and this was day two after the earthquake, you know, they were sending physicians down there. They needed someone who knew the lay of the land. And I had spent 3 years just doing exactly that. And at the same time, you know, while I'm watching it on the news, I was at residency interviews when the earthquake happened. And I was sitting in New York thinking, like, should I go home? Are they going to need me? You know, my mom's calling me like, they're not going to send you, are they? And I thought, no way. And then the next thing I knew, I was on a plane down there.
How soon after the earthquake were you down there?
Day five. So I was a little even late to the party for the rest of the docs that were down there. But UM scaled up an enormous response. I mean, to this, after a career now, you know, I've really never seen anything quite like it. A 240 bed field hospital that was there for months. And as you know, is now still in a bricks and mortar facility.
Yeah, the response by the University of Miami was simply remarkable, phenomenal, and unprecedented.
Totally.
And the attempt to alleviate the human suffering among the Haitians was just incredible.
Yes.
And you were at the heart of it. You were coordinating it.
Yeah.
What was your exact role?
The hospital was on the grounds of the airport. And so... essentially, all of the militaries that were involved were stationed there, but primarily the U.S. military was working to coordinate patient transfers to higher levels of care out to the U.S. Navy ship, the Comfort, and back to the United States to a variety of places. So in addition,
called Vincent initially.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where I operated.
So essentially a lot of patients, a lot of the most critical patients would end up at the UM facility, and then moving those patients to higher levels of care was a big coordination job between other hospitals, other NGOs, local facilities, and then the US military. So I mostly manned those logistics of getting patients moved around the city and moved towards evacuation.
How much sleep did you get?
You know, I was there for 3 straight weeks initially, and I had to fly home for my own wedding. And so when I did, we're still married, but yeah, close call.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, I actually arrived home and I was hallucinating. I was so tired, but you were so, like, you know, adrenaline fueled at that point that by the time I stopped to take a break, I kind of couldn't see straight. So it was an intense experience.
So that's an interesting detail that I didn't realize. But here you had done a lot of planning. You had even put together a 70-page thesis looking at how to prepare in a place like in a resource poor environment.
Yeah.
And then you got a chance to implement that.
Yeah.
That plan, so to speak. That doesn't happen too often.
No,
and,
luckily.
But the only thing in the planning, you didn't plan to organize your wedding while you're in the disaster.
No, and that, you know, that wedding planning is its own disaster management scenario that I was happy to pass off to other willing participants.
In looking now more than 14 years since that earthquake, and where do you feel that critical care, trauma, and so forth in Haiti stands? And we'll talk a little bit about the current situation now, but in terms of your assessment prior to the recent calamities,
yeah,
where do you feel the place stands in terms of trauma and critical care?
Yeah, I think it was leaps and bounds better. You know, the infrastructure is better, the pre-hospital care is better, the attention towards training is better. You know, UM really, you know, is facilitating a neurosurgical residency program, pediatric residency program, which includes critical care. You know, I think when you're working in austere environments over the long term, it is you always feel like you're a little bit behind the eight ball. But then when you take a step back every couple of years, every 5 years, a decade, you look and say, all this stuff we did, you know, and really the infrastructure is leaps and bounds better than it was before.
And in addition to continuing the primary care work that brought you to Haiti as a freshman medical student, now you and the Global Institute have helped reestablish a critical care trauma hospital network that, my understanding, is one of the most high-functioning centers in Haiti, at least prior to the recent.
Yeah, actually, we got the reports yesterday from PAHO. It's still probably the most high-functioning place on the ground.
Hôpital d'Annemarie.
Correct. Yes, exactly. I mean, they're doing more than admirable job at managing extremely, extremely difficult conditions now. And that's because you prepare for this, right? It's not going to go great. That's the thing about emergency management. It's like being the kicker in football, right? Either you're doing what's expected or you're screwing it up, and like there's no glory attached to it. But what they're able to do is incredible. And the SITREP situation reports that we were getting yesterday is that Bernard Bruns is still crisis.
Still carrying the flag.
Yeah.
Let me turn away a little bit from Haiti. We'll come back to it at the end of the podcast. But the Global Institute does more than just report Haiti. Tell us a bit more about some of the recent engagements, such as after Hurricane Dorian in the Bahamas.
Yeah. I feel slightly responsible for my own, you know, destiny here, because every time I seem to go somewhere, some big, big disaster follows me around. I went, you know, from Haiti directly up to New York.
It's preparation.
I know. Job security.
Preparation, see.
I know. Exactly.
Tell us.
So Dorian happened in the Bahamas the summer, fall.
September of 2019.
Right before COVID. And I think, you know, just to give a plug for primary care in the setting of disasters, you know, what you see and what we saw in Haiti is that if you unmask weaknesses in your primary care infrastructure during a disaster, you know, the first, you know, 10 minutes a week, that might be emergency medicine, that might be trauma surgery. But in terms of how resilient your healthcare system is, a lot of that falls on the primary care systems. So in Dorian, I think we played a unique role that is really well suited to academic medical centers, which is that you're really looking at being that medium to long range partner in the setting of a disaster. Because once all those players leave the field in the first couple weeks or months, then, you know, there is a ton of opportunity post-disaster to shore up your infrastructure. You have funding, you have interest, you've seen where the system has fallen apart. And so that's kind of the role that we've played post Dorian in the Bahamas. You know, we have a very strong partner in the Ministry of Health of the Bahamas. And
give us some concrete examples, because we were providing some training with some of our physicians, where I understand Global Institute was sending physicians to spend time there, and then clinic and community outreach. So tell us
more. Yeah. So the initially we were responders like everyone else. You know, the we did initial assessments of the immediate needs. Some clinicians filled in the gaps for staffing at Marsh Harbor all the way up until COVID stopped us in February. And then, you know, we really started looking at some of the longer term effects, the infrastructure that they had there in terms of staffing needs was really dependent on housing, right? So we put up a building, right? That's not necessarily doctor stuff, but that is infrastructure stuff that doctors need, nurses need to have a strong healthcare system.
And you did that in partnership with another NGO?
Yes, we were doing that with one of our favorite long-term partners, Direct Relief, which typically is like a pharmaceutical delivery mechanism.
Right, they provide drugs and
exactly
fluids and things like that.
Exactly, exactly. So when we respond, generally we respond in partnership with them. You know, we have a counterpart.
Yeah, medical supplies you need.
Exactly. And then we are the personnel. And when, you know, when we were there, we were looking at those needs and really there was nowhere to put anyone. So so that became an immediate need. And then also immediately thereafter became very clear that that a mental health response was necessary. And so some training between our physicians, their physicians, and mental health support in terms of supporting their staff and their patients for mental health services.
And you're still continuing some of
Yep, those are ongoing.
Tell us about what else you're doing now, about the floating library.
Yes, so and one often neglected arena, a subset of the mental health piece is about kids. And, you know, the expectations is there that kids are very resilient. They'll bounce back. They'll forget about it. And the Bahamas got hit with that double whammy. So it was really back-to-back Dorian. Then COVID started almost immediately thereafter. And problems unique to small island states is that, you know, the isolation under lockdown, you couldn't even get, you know, in the Bahamas, you couldn't even move between the islands of the Bahamas. Kids were out of school. And same as here, you know, reflected a lot of PTSD about the storm, about COVID, about their isolation, and then decreasing literacy rates. So some of the pediatricians on our team, we have a strong group of the Med Peds department on the Global Institute team. They saw a need for both improving literacy and preparedness and the mental health around having gone through a disaster for children. And I've accompanied them on a few of those trips to schools and with their floating library concept, which brings, you know, books and emergency preparedness lessons to elementary school age children. It's remarkable to see, you know, what they're afraid of and how they had to cope with a really, really scary disaster.
And that's quite a range of engagement or involvement for the Global Institute of active participation in the disaster response and medical needs.
Yeah.
Building a structure so you can provide the care, engaging in mental health, and then out in literacy project. And so this really shows the breadth of our engagement. And maybe you want to say a word about several of our trustees who have been instrumental in supporting this particular engagement because of our proximity, UM as a university, to our sister island, the Bahamas.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the financial support that we have received after disasters on behalf of our trustees and Mr. Miller, and I really have a tremendous admiration for the community stewardship that our backers have for this institution and then beyond this institution, taking this institution to the community. I mean, that is 100% why I work here. And I think, you know, that is the most fantastic thing about this place.
And with our presidencies, we are going to be the hemispheric university. And this is not just in words.
Truly. Yeah.
Our trustees, their engagement, and their philanthropic activities really reflect that priority.
Yeah.
Well, great. I'm so glad you were able to talk a little bit about that. You know, before I close out on the Haiti situation, I think it's ironic that mostly small nations that really play almost no role in greenhouse gas.
Climate change,
end up suffering most.
Totally.
The most from climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about that and how the Global Institute is beginning to try to address this issue.
Right. I mean, I think, one is that there's a institutional focus, which I think is so on brand for UM to think about resilience and capacity building in the setting of climate change. I mean, we are living this in Miami every single day. And from what I do, right, that's not subtle, right? I mean, the health effects of climate change, when you're thinking about it in a disaster context, right, you're drowning in your living room, right? It's not like some downstream thing, theoretical. This is scary, scary stuff. And I think, how we work in concert with, the Umbrella Institution, the Climate Resilience Academy, and how we work with Rosensteel and all these other places, disasters give you that opportunity to do a very multidimensional response and also have a very concrete way for people to see it in action, right?
And this is relevant not just for, Latin America and the Caribbean, but also for
us.
South Florida.
Yeah, it's dependent on it. I think one thing that's happened in disaster response is that you are really thinking about resilience from day one of that response, as opposed to like, this is going to be an in and out short term engagement. And part of that is, I think this is where UM has the opportunity to truly shine, because, we want, disaster response to be done right. But also, I don't want it to be done at all, right? I want to retire. And so thinking about building those systems much, much better in the setting of we know is coming, stronger storms, and heat and all of those insults that are coming our way in our local environment. We got to get ahead of that rather than calling me, right?
So from what we've gathered, the audience has gathered from the past almost 28 minutes that we've been talking, you're an action-oriented person, a surgeon wannabe. But we recognize that we don't like to sulk. Having said that, how does it feel to see the gang violence that's taking place in a country that's so near and dear to you and me, but not be able to intervene to meet the needs of the suffering people? People who are getting burned, people who are getting shot, and so forth. So tell us, and what's the Global Institute's position here?
Yeah, I take it personally. It hurts badly. And, we have our colleagues that are down there doing the actual work. And then you just, I go to meetings and we're all staring at each other like, what are we going to do?
And you can't get supplies to them, and they must be running out of supplies by now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we were in Puerto Rico last week with Direct Relief, also staring at each other thinking, the airport's closed, we can't get down there. I think, a little bit of a shift in the past few days to a week, even though this has been simmering and going on for so long in a very difficult way on the ground, is that something has got to happen where either it's going to get worse, God forbid, but then someone's going to have to open up a humanitarian corridor and take action outside of what is functionally a war zone. I mean, I sort of view it as really, really a complex humanitarian emergency at this point, meaning that it's sort of war zone-esque. And either that's going to happen with some sort of military support, or things are going to get better. And then we're going to have to think about, too, you know, how we respond and how we take action. I mean, right now, I feel like the best thing that I'm doing is writing checks. And although that's relatively useless in terms of my, you know, desire to get down there, you know, that's important. And that's neglected now as well, is that, you know, the funding still needs to keep going in that direction, because those programs that are on the ground, Bernard Luz, all the primary care delivery systems, those are going. They're still going every day.
And they're still in the supplies.
Absolutely.
And if, whether or not we're able to provide them now or after the violence stops, we will still need supplies. So
yeah.
I take great heart to what you have to say about making sure the support continues to come, donations continue to arrive.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, hard to believe that our time is already up. It's just been one fun conversation. It's just been great engaging with you, learning more about the Global Institute, and certainly your background. And it's just, and I hope our audience is truly inspired by it.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
And hopefully we'll be able to host you again after things calm down in Haiti, so we can hear what you have done or what you are doing.
We will be taking action. I know this is the ethos of this university, and resistance is futile.
That's great. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And this has been yet another episode of UMiami, Inside UMiami Medicine, with the fabulous Dr. Gray, the person who planned a wedding during a disaster. See you next time.